This is getting serious. I want to know how to say that which can be said about Somatic Philosophy, so I can write it out as course material, and what must be done at the edge of language. For this sixth episode, I'm talking to Karin Eglinton, coach and mentor at Intergifted, who's Skyping with me from Leipzig, Germany. And my name is Miriam van der Valk.
Super exciting topic. I'm so glad you brought it up.
Yeah. What are you first thinking when you hear those words together?
Somatic philosophy. Well, actually, the first thing that comes to mind is thinking with the body.
Yes. What do you mean by thinking, if you can do it with the body?
Well,
do you mean reasoning?
No. In a way, yeah.
Yeah. Yes?
I do think that's what I mean.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of something in particular, which is in the gifted community, we've had... You know, I've had a few conversations with people, sometimes with clients, and it's about how they wonder how they can be gifted if they've never, you know, been like high achievers or like experts at chess or math or science.
If they don't even like board games, winning things.
And then. As we explore together in the conversation, and I have to say this has been part of my own exploration as well, it becomes clear that there's another avenue of exquisite reasoning that occurs not through what we normally call thinking. And it happens through the body. It happens through sensation, Well, I don't want to say hunches because that's like it's colored with the idea of intuition, but I connect these two things. Processing is happening that might be experienced as movement. A processing is happening that might be experienced as vibrations going through the body, and the vibrations themselves carry meaning.
Yes. Yeah. What sort of meaning? Is it a meaning something like fear? Like, do you know what I'm
right? Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
So actually, I think that you could say at a, let's say, basic level, we could look at it as, yeah, there are signals coming through that are, for example, don't touch that or go this way or there's danger over there or I will like to do this. So like, pleasure, fear, pure affects that arise through the body and that communicate something.
Yes.
But there's also a different layer as well, which I think is interesting, that it seems to carry more complex meaning or perhaps combinations of these affects that, in a way, rather than just being a single word, communicate full sentences of or paragraphs or, you know, a whole discourse of knowledge that is downloaded, so to speak, in a single moment of experience. Yeah. So for me, it's been personally interesting to explore that avenue of knowledge and validate that it is real, first of all. Just that act of saying, oh, look, there's a path over here and there's really cool things down that path. And then seeing what that brings me. I think there's an aspect of, I don't know if I want to say pragmatism to that way of thinking of that. The body thinking, but just something to do with it being very contextually bound.
Yeah.
Which perhaps in some ways makes it seem less because it cannot be sort of universalized. Everybody's body language is different. And by body language, I don't mean the gestures they make, but how their body speaks to them.
Yes, so it's contextual, and it's not the same as sort of hearing the voice in your head, and it's also not the same as say asking your intuition or asking the higher self within a question, because the way I think about the higher self is that it communicates in only yes or no. So this is so you say like a whole paragraph, a whole sentence that comes as a vibration, but the paragraph and the sentence is just a metaphor for stuff to interpret. Wait, I'm trying to, like, I want to be able to write this down and make sort of course material out of it. That's the long term plan. So we need to make sure what it isn't,
yeah,
as well as what it is. Wait, was that what I was saying? I had this thought. Yes, yeah. So the way I've been thinking about meaning and interpretation is mm-hmm. that the interpretation is a mind tool.
Mm-hmm.
If the message is downloaded, I think you said downloaded, didn't you?
Yeah, I used that word.
So if the message is downloaded, and it comes as a sense, a bodily sense, a bodily sense and a body knowledge. Yeah, and the way that's then a form of reasoning. So reason is with rationale. So it mm-hmm. has to do with sort of next steps or mm-hmm. like painting the picture, like placing or like, you know, drawing the map or whatever mm-hmm. you want to say. So it means that this body sensation that you get a body sensation informs one about the situation one is in. Yes.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, yeah. I would definitely agree. Now, what's interesting is, of course, that separation, or like trying to make sure what it is and what it isn't, which is funny in some ways, because it's very hard to separate, for me, very hard to separate what is mind and what is body and what is heart or entire self. And of course, it makes sense to try to separate them out at times to understand them better, how each work together with the others. And at the same time, when they come together, it's like they're playing a symphony and it's really hard to make out which one's which.
Yes. The reason that I've kind of, that I'm trying to separate them is that, is to be able to make course material. So what is the written stuff and what is in the last episode that I made, which was in Swedish, super interesting guy, Joseph, who is a psychologist. He's 71, I think. And he became a healer. He started with healing in his psychology practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talked about, the episode wasn't at all about what he does with his patients practically, but sort of how a person becomes a psychologist and where the words end. Handledning, is that German as well? Handleitung, like mentoring. So leading by the hand. So mm-hmm. we had all of these nice. I recently heard that being in labor, like childbirth labor, in Hebrew mm-hmm. is something like what was it now? Leida, I think. And it means if you combine the letters in a different way, which you always do in Hebrew, mm-hmm. because to make all sorts of mystical connections, it's by the hand of God, the hand of God. Yeah.
Oh.
That's very nice. So it's something with the hands, and it's something, the things with the hands can't be written down in language. So this is sort of another question that has been in my mind through these other episodes. Can we talk about this? Is it sayable, somatic philosophy? Can we have wisdom seeking with the body? And what do we, how would he, you know?
So. Yeah, totally. And I think we're already exploring that because I'm using all these metaphors and you're using metaphors. And we know it's like we can talk around it without, we could talk around it for days.
Yes. Yeah.
And actually, so in that sense, it makes a lot of sense to try to define things. And there is obviously a limitation to trying to speak about it for too long, as though the other person hasn't experienced it.
And when we say the body is, the wisdom seeking is bodily wisdom seeking. Mm-hmm. There must be, we have to show something. We have, it's doing and it's being and it's thinking, as if thinking means using language, like processes with language and words. And it's a, I lost my point now. I don't know why I started talking. I think I'm just trying to still clarify.
Yeah, and we can continue to clarify. So what is the unclearest part?
Whether the, so this this comes from a person who was very much in the head forever till I had my like crisis when I was 33 and I started going to the gym and stuff, and I noticed the huge difference, the world life changing difference when you start to think about your diet and working out.
Yeah, truly.
Yes. So the unclearest part for me, even though that I have that experience, but, you know, I have told people about this experience. You know, it's life-changing. Everything changes when you start to check what your diet should be, you know, when you start experimenting. Or when you start working out, and I have this particular friend in mind right now who I'm telling, and he's just going like, yeah, you know, I've heard that before. And, you know, and like he doesn't believe any part of it. So, so the communicating the experience of, inhabiting your body, that's one thing. And the slightly silly question that I still have in my head, sort of, is the body, it is very silly, is the body capable of doing anything at all? You can hear how I've escaped to my head, you know, for most of my life, because with this deep distrust of the real world. But I'm, you know, I'm doing this series because I suspect I'm convinced that there is something more to it than we can't understand the world and what it means to be a person and purpose and everything from an armchair. That we need to do something. We need to be in our bodies.
Yeah.
But what does it mean to have a body?
I know. It's like part of me is just like just rejoicing at that question. And there's like, that's it. You know what? I want to sort of jump to a different area, which I think will circle back to this, if that's okay.
Good. I was kind of stuck anyway.
It's all right. We're not going to run out of things to talk about.
No.
Well, the thing that I wanted to connect this to was this thing that I sort of hinted at in my email to you. The body, because you said your thing is about relationships. You were referring to me, right?
Yes.
My thing being relationships.
Yes. And, oh, good.
And that's the connection that I draw here. The body is a node of relationships, and therefore being in the body sort of forces us to remember, if you will, and experience that we are always in relationship, and that, you know, like relationship, when you say it in this context, it can sound really fuzzy and nice, you know, like, oh yeah, we're all connected, that's beautiful. But but actually a lot of these relationships are very problematic. You know, just like marriage, uncomfortable, unpleasant, painful, not fun in any way. And being in the body is like, it's sort of the sobering up of having to admit to the fact that even though I might not want this relationship, I am in it.
Yes.
And I think that's in some ways what is hinted at when many of us, myself included, have spent a lot of time in our heads, have been taught to spend a lot of time in our heads. And we need to do that because the reality of the physical relationship to everything is really unpleasant.
Yeah, sensations are unpleasant often.
Yeah. And particularly if we're not used to them, and if, you know, like I myself consider myself highly sensitive. So going into a crowded street can be overwhelming. Being exposed to certain kinds of sensations is overwhelming. So it's not necessarily a feeling of safety. And one thing that I know is that for relationship and for presence in the body and for, you know, for connection and for enjoyment, there needs to be a foundation of safety. And if our senses feel assaulted, that's going to, in a way, hijack the nervous system to say, get out of there or be paralyzed. And so a lot of our living in the head can be tracked to that, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yes, I also consider myself highly sensitive. And was you said, I bet it was you, something about being both very highly stimulatable and yes, it was you, and at the same time very easily understimulated, so you have this extremely narrow ultimate path, you know. I have that too. It's very 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 hard to negotiate, and no wonder that you would go into the head. But it was so much better. Everything became so much better when I changed my diet and started working out. Everything.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing that if you approach it with a problem solving, like a problem oriented mind or a linear oriented mind, it doesn't necessarily make sense at first glance, but it's more of a systemic thing. You know, like you become a more vibrant, healthy experiencer of life.
And more relatable and more subjective, like everything. When you sort of, I don't want to repeat myself in the word inhabit, but it's a good word. When you allow your consciousness to sip through the tips of your fingers and toes, so that you know exactly these senses. When you can, you know, I don't want to say the edges of me, because it's. That also isn't true, because I don't stop at where my skin, you know, but okay, so I'll just say that then. To know that you have a skin.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, like a point of contact.
Yes, a point of contact, yeah, with the sensory, a sensory point, because,
Yeah, that's beautiful. So let me see where that takes me. Or if you have any other thoughts, feel free.
One thing I, of course, wanted to talk about was that we had originally booked another time for this session. And then as that day approached, I was getting more and more apprehensive, because we had I was going away on a trip and my little baby daughter got ill and we needed antibiotics and it was just a mess. So I emailed you emailed and asked, are we still on? And I had this intense feeling that you had picked up my signals, because I had obviously been thinking about you in particular, like directing my thought at you, thinking I don't want to cancel, but I think we need to postpone. Yeah. And it's like you picked this up and asked about it. So at that moment, I thought maybe I'm because I've heard many times that I'm a person with a lot of energy, and I know it's the case. So I figured maybe I'm the type of person who can send out my own energy, but I'm not as good as picking up. But on the other hand, that can't be true, because I picked up that you had received.
<That's cool>. Nice.
Yeah. But yeah, and so I asked you about it in a very roundabout way.
Well, yeah, and as I had said, well, it's in a way somewhat out there connections, but without ascribing any ideology to them, I can say subjectively that is my experience.
Mm.
And without trying to make an explanation for it, and without trying to put it in some kind of a box, I definitely do live with the existence or like the reality of these kinds of interconnected intuitive communications, let's say, and I take them really seriously. So
yes.
And I take them really seriously in a way where where they help me be more connected to life rather than bypassing life.
Mm.
And I've had many an acquaintance and family member, a friend who has used these experiences to bypass. That's how I was taught when I grew up.
Mm.
And which by this, what I mean is using messages from the universe, or like you say, from the higher self, or from your intuition, as a way to ignore reality, or a way to distance from reality, from real problems, from real struggles, and as a way also to decrease the discomfort of confrontation, for example, or of taking the furthest point from A to B, and instead using your mind to think your reality. So I've lived with that experience. I've lived with that as a way of framing intuition and interconnectedness, or energetic interconnectedness, let's say. And I have learned over time that there's another much more reality-based, let's say, side. And here, reality-based meaning that it impacts reality, and it fosters, things working in your life rather than bypassing things not working.
Mm.
So then from that standpoint, having been always a person who picks up a lot of these things and who broadcasts as well, taking them seriously and taking responsibility in some ways for it, has meant, like a lot of exploration, a lot of joy, and a lot of magical things happening like that.
I also take it very seriously. Yeah, for a long time, and also just like you said, it needs to be said. Don't want to put it in a box or anything. It is an interesting thing to talk about when you notice that it happens again and again with several people, that they somehow seem to understand what you need. So you ask, did I tell you? And the other way around. And then you did, we did tell each other. And the way I like to think about it is from this Moomin character book by Tove Jansson, a Swedish story for children, like Swedish Finnish. But there's this quote in one of the books that I love these books, by the way.
Oh, cool.
And this is quoted in one of the books, and it says, Mama Moomin sent her son a greeting in the usual way, and he felt it as he sat in the garden or something, you know, as it like a tinkle in the ear or whatever, and or nothing at all. And I, so I figured, and then this was the sentence that I was reminded of when I read your email response. And that's how I feel about it too. It's a very unstrange, unmythical, mystical thing. It's like a very simple, straightforward thing. So I immediately started trying to send a greeting to my big daughter, who wasn't at home at the time. And I just had the sense that, you know, I just saw her in my mind's eye sitting on her bed doing something on her phone, YouTube or something, and then, you know, getting this little message that I love her, you know. And that's enough. It's not like I need to call her and check, did you just have a feeling that I love you or whatever? it's too much, you know. And so and I've also tried doing this with other people, and I had a significant feeling that it wasn't received because they were completely closed off, just like I have been completely closed off in periods in my life, for sure, you know.
So
this is about and then now that we're on the out there field, what I do when if I need to send something to someone who I feel is closed off, I just try to sort of surround them in my mind's eye with something warm and fuzzy. And then I leave them there. And I say, well, I'll just wait for you. You know?
Well, for me, one thing that's interesting in the connection to back to somatic philosophy of this is the fact that these, we could call them, you know, clairvoyant or psychic or energetic, and yet they're very much physical, at least to me. They're experiences that are felt in the body, and that's where I've sort of from this channel, like through this intuitive way in, I started to take my body more seriously, because I found myself many times sort of crossing the threshold into experiences that seemed fully just in the present moment physical or emotional, and discovering later that they had been energetic, and then going, oh, there's something more here.
Yes. Again, the relationality and the how it really isn't the case that we are separate individuals who are, I'm just talking about something and you're taking in whatever you can take in as a sort of closed psychological system. You're understanding things based on your psychological history from, you know, when you were born. This is also true, but it's not the whole story.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. That is how I experience it, for sure. And I give also due weight to that view, which I guess some people would call like a more logical or empirical view, I don't know. And somehow the two inhabit my reality together.
Yeah, they do with me too. Yeah. And especially when it comes to this, do you want to say more?
No, go ahead.
Yeah. Especially when it comes to this being closed, completely closed off, like I said before, and like I have been too, because this, the closed offness is, that is psychologically closed off, a psychological mechanism that closes you off. Yes, it's the psyche. So that you have moved into your psyche and you believe that that is the whole you. So in a sense, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because it becomes you, since you are able to close off all the other stuff. And then the experiencing of like getting these messages in your body, when you're in this, what should you call it? Like a psychology state or something. It's like psychological. No, that's not good. Like when you're in that slightly closed off place.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know what I would exactly call it. I guess part of me wants to say self-focused, but that's also inaccurate.
Yeah, self with a small s.
Yeah, like, well, when you set a closed, like a closed psychological system, that feels the most accurate.
Yeah, closed psychological system, yes, okay. So and then when you get these messages, you don't interpret them correctly. It's like they interpret the mind, the interpreting function doesn't work.
Yeah, yes.
So you get the messages, and so how does this relate to somatic wisdom seeking? We have to have the psychology in here too. I'm thinking again about the course material.
What I think happens is that there are sort of layers in a way built on top of the pure somatic signal. Like that's how I picture it in my mind. Like the layers of interpretation.
Yes.
Narrative,
yeah.
It's not like we're not experiencing the somatic layer. We're just focusing on the things that are on top, layers upon layers. And then when, you know, like, it makes it hard for me to talk about because, you know, sometimes I've learned even that my interpretation layers make sense in the context. So it's not even that I can say there's a pure somatic signal and that's the pure somatic wisdom thing.
Yes.
It's more about how the body connects these dots. And I almost imagine it as though my body, my brain, my nervous system, all that is physical here, all of it is trying to send me, my conscious mind, a message. And it uses the best things at hand.
Yes. Yes, and the reason, just to connect what you started by saying, the reason that it's not like a pure message that your body is getting and then your mind sort of distorts it is that we are actually creating the world we live in. So it's not like we are minds in bodies and the body can tell us something about what's going on in the real world and the mind is this guest.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yes.
And I want to give an additional sort of funny example to illustrate what I mean too. So my ex-boyfriend, he had a funny habit of worrying about money when he was very hungry. And over time, we just talked about it because he would get into these, like, you know, very intense sort of thought spirals about money, even at times where there were no money problems. And then somehow, someday, we figured out that it's like his blood sugar was spiraling out of control, and then this would happen. And his awareness, it's like it was as though his body was sending the usual signals, you know, hunger and so on. And he was not paying attention to those. So it had to send something that he would pay attention to. And then he started eating every time he got worried about money. And then the problem went away. So I think that's what I mean by saying the narrative is, you know, it serves a purpose. It's just sometimes not at face value.
Yeah. Yes, and this is what we mean by wisdom, you know, that it's difficult to be wise when you're 20.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you need a lot of life you need a lot of experience with sensing and interpretation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Before you can appreciate the interplay of your psychological narrative, the wounding and what it tells you about your place in the world, and then also your I'm trying to summarize again things. Yeah, this happens all the time now that I lose myself midway.
Yeah, I wonder if that has anything to do with your body sending some signals that are getting sort of, it's like two waves crashing into each other.
Yeah, maybe it's also when you, this Skype, because it goes completely silent when you aren't not talking.
So it's that, like, just feels like, where did she go?
Yeah, so I have this sense that you are waiting You're waiting and I need to sort of, oh, bless you.
I understand. Yeah. Isn't that interesting too in the context of what we're talking about? Because that would be, if we were face to face, you could have the context, you know, like we would have a shared physical context. And our bodies would be talking to each other at the same time as our voices reach each other's ears. So then it's like not having that context makes it confusing and sort of disorienting.
This is so important that we're doing. I'm so happy about how different all of these episodes are becoming. In fact, the last one with this Joseph psychologist who started with healing, we were sitting here at my place, and if I listen to it now, I can see well, I talk obviously a little bit in the beginning and the end to sort of introduce and out-introduce, but during the actual conversation, it was he talks the entire time, and it was partly because I was crying. It was a very I don't really know why I cried so much. I was prepared for when he stepped in. I knew it was going to be crying. But afterwards, I also thought that the dynamic of just him and me opposite each other and him talking and I'm just crying and I hardly say anything, like hardly anything at all.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But it's sort of, it's another hugely important relationality.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That makes me think of a million things and I can't even articulate all of them at once. I need like five mouths.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to get to see what happens also when our connection is mediated by technology.
Yeah.
And in a way, were you also talking over Skype with Joseph?
No.
Okay, so then that was an in-person.
Yeah, that was an in-person. was in-person. That's what I meant. That's how different it was. That was in-person, and with all our like who we are, our persons.
Yeah.
You know.
And did that help you feel sort of that it was okay to just cry?
That it was okay to cry. I think, yeah, I'm in the process where I'm thinking like, you know, the new type of professional person doesn't try to hold the tears in, you know, at all cost, if they really need to come. And it sort of means something. And also with this series in particular, I've said out loud and to myself so many times that, it's an exploration that I don't know, you know, I don't count on any particular insights at all. It's during these conversations, but you know, I think in a year from now or 10 years from now, reflection will show what it was that happened. And just looking at this conversation compared to the last one and the one before, and you know, it's, that's what's going to give the most important hints.
It's also the relationship of the parts to the whole.
Yes.
And to each other.
And also I have no idea how many parts there will be because it keeps popping up new ones.
Wonderful.
Yes it is wonderful.
That if you know the wisdom seeking through the body, if I had to take out, encapsulate a couple of the insights of wisdom seeking through my body, it would come through that aspect of the body is a process and not an object. Mm. So like just shifting the focus, you know, of course I can see my body as an object and that gives me a set of circumstances and ways of seeing the world and ways of interacting with things. And there's another way in which I can experience things when my internal subjective feelings are all considered process feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And the body is a wave, not a particle, if you know what I mean.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I've been reading author Risa Kapero's work. She talks about awakening somatic intelligence, and she talks about this very much. Although I have to say that I have for a very long time felt this, you know, this being a wave, not a particle.
Mm-hmm.
And now reading her and discussing it with some of the intergifted peers,
mm-hmm.
it's been, you know, returning to that feeling and validating that is an okay way to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that the process orientation, when it's applied not just to the body, but then to everything that the body touches. And like, if my body is a process, then the body of the tree outside is a process, and the body of whatever it is that I'm eating is a process, and so on and so forth. That creates a completely different worldview.
Mm.
And so I would say that has been one of the biggest things. And the second thing that also sort of stems from that is trust, learning to trust that what the body is saying makes sense, even if I don't understand it right now.
Yeah. More about trust, yes?
Yeah. Well, I have, as you know, a background of chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one very iconic episode for me, which was getting very sick, and very sick with something that is very bizarre in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing right away what it was, just like... like a crazy person from a Google search saying, this is what I have, and I don't know how I'm going to find out that it's true, but I need to find out it's true because I need treatment.
Mm.
And then having a whole year's worth of doctor's visits and research and contacting other people over the internet and other people who have the same disease and, you know, seeking out help, always driven by this weird knowing that it's this and nothing else.
Yeah,
and so that proved to be true in the end.
Yeah.
And so the day that I got the test that sort of everything else hinged on, I was both joyous and shocked. And it's like, oh great, you get this diagnosis of something really weird that happens with your body that nobody understands, and you're happy about it. How crazy are you? It's like, that's what's going through my mind.
Mm.
But I was happy because I knew that I could trust my body.
Yeah.
That it was trying to tell me, and that it was an act of faith on my part to trust it as though it was another person. You know, it's like, there's two people living in this body. One, the one that thinks that this might be true, and the other one that thinks this might be crazy. Mm. And since then, I use that experience and others like that to continue to help me navigate situations in which I really have no clue.
That when you say this, I'm reminded of my dad who... he died several years ago from a brain tumor. But when he first got the brain tumor, I was 5, and he started going to Germany for this alternative treatment. And he came back with, among other things, a pendulum thing. Is that what you call it? So he was holding it over foods instead of asking it in his head if he could eat it or not and how much of it, and it would go either left or right and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then after he died, I completely forgot about this pendulum for several years.
Yeah.
Talk about being closed off and being in a closed psychological system state. That was me after he died for a while, for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, at a certain point, I walked past this shop and I figured I'm going to buy a pendulum thing. It was this kind of shop with rainbows and the
and angels and, you know, sell little stones and stuff. It's one of my favorite places.
Yeah,
I love those hanging stories. Out.
Yeah. Always pretty stones.
Always pretty stones, I know. I love pretty stones. I really do. So I walked in there and I bought this, and it didn't cost much at all. It was this glass thing. And then I figured that, so I was, and during that day it was quite hot, lots of tourists and lots of people in the shop. And I'm like, so how does it work? What do I do? And she looked at me like, you know, she was trying to explain to this. I had like really colorful clothes, weird things that I had made myself, and high heels and whatever. Looking at her like I was much taller than she as well. And I'm like, how does it work? What do I do? And she's like, well, you ask it, give me a yes, give me a no, and then you see what way it turns. And I'm like, you know. The shop was just too full, so I went home. And then I ended up like not using it. I carried it around for a long time. And then I asked, at a party, I mentioned that I had bought this pendulum, and with a giggle, like, look what I got, this crazy new age thing. And this guy said that he also had one for several years, and that he didn't use it very much, but he used it for important questions like, should I go on this trip or something? So I asked myself, would I need to do that? And I figured that wouldn't need to use the pendulum to ask whether I should go on a trip, because that would be a more easy thing for me to just know anyway, whether that was right or not. But I wanted to check with foods. But then I figured I can actually just hold the food and ask, can I eat this? Should I eat this?
Yeah.
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 You get a direct answer. Immediately I know whether I can or not. And then, for instance, some very nice things like bread, butter, sandwiches, which is my favorite food, and some of the things I really shouldn't eat. It's not like I die from it, but I suffer a little bit.
Yeah.
But anyway, so if I eat that anyway, I have this voice and that I'm like telling, I'm telling myself, I'm going to eat this sandwich now. It's like I'm telling this well-meaning part of me, because I want to. I'm doing it anyway. Yeah. And then I also remember what I read in a book, if you do this with your unconscious a lot, it's going to stop talking to you if you go against
yeah,
it.
I've heard that too.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I can say just for myself, because I have heard this. And in my case, just as a counterexample, it's not that it ever stopped talking to me, but it's, you know, like I do connect it to my body getting sick. Previous times that there were many things that I was feeling the feelings of, this is not right for me, and doing it anyways. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like it never stopped talking, but it just got louder.
Yeah. It's like, if you're not listening, well, I'm going to have to.
Yeah.
But
it makes sense to me that for some people it's a shutdown, and for some other people it's a melt, like a meltdown in a way.
Yeah. I'm giggling because right now I'm so allergic, and it's like I'm literally melting because it's just like dripping for me.
I feel for you. It's tough. I know.
Yeah.
I know.
And I also giggle at myself a little bit, because it's so easy for me to go into this state where everything is a metaphor for something else. So even the real sneezing and the real snot suddenly becomes what do I need to fix in my unconscious life, you know? So this connection is also interesting.
Super interesting.
Yes. Yeah. And boy, it's been crossed in wrong ways, you know, in. So I don't want to go there, but yeah.
It's a dark story for another time.
And for many people, I think many people have been told that you can think away your cancer, or you know, you just think positively or whatever.
I've shared this with our community as well. Like, that's been part of experiences that I had of real spiritual abuse with things like that.
It's abuse. That's what it is.
And yet there's a more non-dual way of doing that as well, where you can listen to the message and see how it fits in different levels. At the physical level, it's one thing, and then at the emotional level, it has a fitting counterpart or something. But it's a tricky tool, I think. It can lead to a lot of bypassing. It can lead to a lot of abuse. And for me, the line that I draw, where I say I will think about it like this or I won't think about it like this, is am I trying to make my body a mechanistic machine where it's like, oh, this one part is broken because, you know, my mind is thinking about this or my feelings are doing this and that broke. And now if I replace this feeling with a new part, all will be better. And that's so... that is destructive to the relationship.
Yes, it is. And you know what? That's actually one of the things that somatic philosophy, when it's a proper discipline, will be able to tackle, because somatic philosophy is about this relationship between these two parts, or these two absolutely. Parts, like all of these parts.
I mean, I think about it sometimes, like, there's a legitimate, you know, space and time to, you know, embrace the body when it's suffering. And then a legitimate place and time to look at it in a problem-solving manner.
Yes. And there is a place and time to dare to ask very kindly, does it have to do with this? Does it have to do with this?
Exactly. And see what I think.
Yeah, and see what the where the response leads you, you know, to dare to walk that path and check, does it really actually have to do with memory?
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah. So, about what you said, the body is a process. When I try to explain in 30 seconds what I, what I mean when I say, and not what I mean, but what I'm sort of trying to understand when I talk about somatic philosophy and I do this series, I say that the body, for instance, is something that we both have and are. And that is usually a sentence that makes you a little bit like, oh, that's right, you know, because we do talk about our bodies as something that we have, but we're, with the body as a process, it's the body is neither, not like what something we are or something we have, but something that we become. And thinking especially about my crisis when I was 33 and going to the gym and changing my diet, it is certainly, it's like the truest word, that the body is something that I become. It's like I was, it's like, in a metaphoric sense, obviously, it's like I'm materializing now first, you know?
Yeah, and like in a lot of somatic lingo, let's say, we talk about embodiment, and I think that in a way that speaks to that very beautifully.
Yeah, embodiment and materializing. Like manifesting. It's funny to say that you're manifesting when the body is something, is what has been always been the most tangible, or the only tangible part of you.
but then if we go back to what you were saying about being in the head, you know, right now I'm reading a book by a somatic educator. His name's Paul Linden. And he's done pretty brilliant work connecting different disciplines to help people be what he calls embodying both power and love at the same time.
Oh, that's nice. That's very Kabbalistic. Nice.
I wonder if there's a connection there. But he works, he's worked all his life with survivors of abuse. And one of the big thrusts of his work is to empower and help survivors of abuse learn how to do different patterns in the body so that they could feel no longer like victims, and how they could potentially defend themselves or assert themselves if they needed to.
Mm-hmm.
But not from a pure self-defense standpoint, but from an internal somatic standpoint. So where was I going with that? He's talking about somatic awareness and in one part of the book, and he's talking about how our attention can be confined to certain parts of our body and not to others.
Yes, yeah.
And so he has an exercise where he says, lie down and have somebody touch you on the shoulder and then on the knee. Which part feels closer?
I love it. That's so funny.
Yeah.
Which part feels closer?
And then he's like, in the book, he's like, don't read what comes after until after you've done that. And then he of course says, how can one side of you be closer than your whole body?
Yes.
But we live in our heads, so then it tends to be that people say the shoulder is closer.
Yeah.
so it's like the body's been there all along, but the attention and the presence hasn't.
Mm.
And so it's like it's like living in just one room of your whole house, and then all of the other rooms stand empty.
Yeah. So and start to stink because you need to go and open.
So I'm saying that to say, there's a very practical aspect to what you're saying about becoming. Like it's not just esoteric.
Mm.
It's really like there's a practical sort of neurological correlation to how we can voluntarily and involuntarily control what parts of us feel like us and which don't.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's very real. It's very real when you go to the gym too, and you notice that, like I did an episode with my Pilates instructor, and like the end comment was that a straight back is a back that doesn't hurt.
Mm.
And that's where you get from a baby has it, but then it bends. I remember drawing these pictures of myself when I was in my 20s. You know, me and my sister, we were sitting there. Oh, I look like this. And then we did this cute, highly ugly thing. When I see this, this completely bent back and like bottom going like with the, it's like you're holding your tail, it's completely weak, like a weak, frightened stance. And it's like on the inside, so one would say as above, so below, but it goes together so clearly.
Yeah.
It really does. Like Marianne Williamson said too, we're all meant to shine like children do.
Mm.
Because they do. They really do. And then we stop.
Yeah. Yeah. Although here I have to interject that we do stop not out of our own free will most of the time.
No. But what happens? I mean, so it's like the little babies are also sort of eating and sleeping. I want to say they're sleeping with their whole bodies, but you know what I mean? They're like completely relaxed everywhere and eating with the entire body, or whatever, everything they do with full somatism.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And that stops. Oh yeah. Because we move into the head, of course.
I mean, there's a lot of trauma that, like, even legitimate in a way, trauma, if you will. I mean, depends on how you're thinking about the world.
Mm.
But I think of myself when I was younger, and clothes were traumatic because my skin is so sensitive.
Mm.
You know, So if I wanted to be a little girl who was free to be fully Semitic, I would have had and needed some adults who understood that I needed different clothes, for example. But imagine all the time that we sit in school.
I think about that a lot.
All the time that we do anything at a table, like at a desk, eat at a table, and so on. There's a lot of socialized behaviors that don't necessarily provide the necessary ecosystem for the body to continue to be vibrant. Then if you add trauma to those things, like real trauma, developmental trauma or shock trauma or any of the variants of trauma, then you have nervous system states that are frozen in place, and that's going to reflect in the body as well.
There's so much healing to be done.
Yes, I
There
love
is
it.
so much healing to be done. At the end of the last episode, this is the first episode where I'm actually talking about other episodes. But it said something about well, the number of episodes I've done. This is the sixth now, so I have something to talk about finally. But at the end of the last episode, I asked in the outro bit what a Semitic philosophy classroom looks like. What do you have in there?
What would I? Well, ha,
Desks
that's a
and
very
yoga
good
mats
question.
and
It ties in with what I was saying when we first started this call. Well, the world is a thematic philosophy classroom, I think.
I was just gonna
It
say it
very
is.
much is. This is something that I am fascinated by, and for the last 2 years, I've slowly tried to tailor my life so that my home is a Semitic philosophy classroom.
Oh, yes, love that.
So it has been an ongoing inquiry about what does my body need to thrive.
Oh, yes. What does your
It
body
hasn't.
need to thrive? It also needs beautiful things, right?
Yeah. This was the conversation in my head this morning. I'm not lying. Not exaggerating. I was like, because I was sensing, tension in my belly as I was organizing my new space. And I was sensing tension, and I tuned into that tension, and I asked, "What is this?" And it was showing me the images of the split between the functional and the beautiful. I was like, "Okay, body, don't worry. We'll find a better solution so we can have both." Because it was really like, I was like, oh no, I don't have enough room to have as much open space as I need, and I'm not enough storage to have as much practicality as I need. Both practical and beautiful and spacious and light and all these things. And so it was a moment to reassure myself that I don't need to live by those paradigms of having to compromise what my body needs. Yeah. So that's my home classroom. But it also, I want to tell you, it also really is an ongoing conversation with Merlin, my husband, who is a person of much Semitic intelligence. I mean, so the conversation includes even things like having indoor monkey bars and things like that. And it has included things like getting rid of our couch and having pillows to sit on the floor or lie on, moving to sleeping on the floor as well.
Yes. Oh, I remember that conversation. That's a good one.
And it has included things like, what do I do with my computer? And where do I put it? And so now I have both a standing desk and a sitting desk that I can just sort of like adjust the height, and my laptop can easily go on one or the other. So it's things like that where I'm just exploring, like, what does my body need? What are the sensory needs? And yeah, does it foster like expansion, that becoming that you were talking about?
Is my home a Semitic philosophy classroom? What can I tweak to foster expansion and becoming? Inhabiting the body. Embodying the mind or the psyche? Embodying the psyche? How many components are there to a person? And how do we attend to them? I mean, in a Semitic philosophy classroom. You can find this and the other episodes, some of which are in Swedish, on philoprax.com, philoprax.com. Look for articles and podcasts in the menu tab, or follow Philoprax on Facebook for regular updates. Bye for now.